Good morning.
Good morning.
So today I'm going to give another talk on Taoism. Where shall I start? Why not start with the fact that when the early Taoists talk about the Tao, they talk about it in two ways. They talk about it as the great mystery, which is totally dark and cannot be cognitively approached, cannot be approached by through our thinking, through our planning, through our wishing, through our desiring. It's totally mysterious, totally dark. Nevertheless, these guys say that it can be imbibed. It can be imbibed. It can be drunk. It's better than wine. It can't be known, but it can be imbibed. That's the first side of the Tao. The second side, and you see like this, you don't really know which is which, right? The second side is that it manifests itself as us, as this, as you, as me, as this. Its manifestation is all life. It is all life. All life coursing through us, coursing as us. The energy, incredible energy. And the delightful part is that if we sink into the mystery, if we let go a little bit of our thinking, not trying to grab anything, we begin to appreciate that within the most common, ordinary life is the Tao itself, is the energy itself. All I have to do is look into this water. I don't have to prepare a talk. All I have to do is look into this water. And all life is there. Everything's there. Wow, look at it. The reflection from the lights, everything's there. Everything's there. So that's the Tao. That's the Tao. And the appreciation that we feel when we just let go for a minute of our thinking and feel this connecting us to everything, makes us very fortunate to have a chance to practice meditation. So last time when I talked, I said that Zen in China, Chan, is the coming together of two forces, Buddhism from India and Taoism, which is already in China. And I talked about four ways in which they come together, in which they have intercourse and create Chan, create Zen. So the first and second that I talked about last time, the father, the Buddhism, restraint, discipline, work, sitting, 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 restraint, discipline, work. The mother, the Taoist mother, Buddhism is the papa and Taoism is mother. Laughter, play, spontaneity, coming together. These two coming together. Second, the father, icon, moving toward perfection, trying to embody the bodhisattvas and the Buddhas in us by using these symbols. And the mother, iconoclasm, imperfection, flawedness. Wow. Wow. They're coming together. Of course, they've never been apart, but coming together in China. Next time, my next talk, I'm going to talk about the father, restraint, especially of sexual and sensual pleasure. Restraint of sensual pleasure, all kinds of sensual pleasure, and the suffering that's involved in getting entangled with sensual pleasure. The papa, Buddha, Buddhism, and the mama. Sensual pleasure is wonderful. joyful, including human sexuality, of those two coming together. And today I'm going to talk about the fourth one. The Father, conceptual, verbal teaching, how important that is. And the Mother, the Tao. Well, conceptual, verbal teaching is okay, but really what's wonderful is the natural world, is the sky, is the earth, is the water, and her teaching, and being with her. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. Okay, got it all memorized? Since I'm half Buddhist, there'll be a test at the end. Since I'm half Taoist, it's going to be a joke test. If you get it wrong, you'll get it right. That kind of test, right? So conceptual, verbal teaching, the Father, scriptures and commentaries. How many scriptures do we have in Buddhism? In Christianity, they just have one Bible. How many do we have? Start studying Buddhism. Start looking at the scriptures and the commentaries and the commentaries on the commentaries and the commentaries on the commentaries on the commentaries. A lot of stuff. And of course, verbal teaching, conceptual teaching is important. We probably wouldn't be here if it weren't for that. I mean, you come here and listen to someone blab on for 45 minutes every Sunday, or maybe you come every Sunday, or every other Sunday, I don't know. It's important. And I've talked before about, some of you may remember the first book you read, or the first something you did, which brought you sort of onto the path. And my first book was this little book that's all, I still have, although the pages are all, it's scotch taped together, basically. The Teachings of the Mystics. And the Sanchkinlong Zan. And then this statement by Jesus that I was not raised Christian, so I didn't know anything about the peace that passes understanding, that's beyond understanding. And that, so I still have that little book. And if it hadn't been for that teaching and finding that little book, I wouldn't be here. It doesn't seem like I would be here, at least. So the conceptual teaching. And when I met my first teacher, Suzuki, it seemed to me that he had imbibed, had drunk that mystery. And he was very, very equanimous, very grandiose, very peaceful. Usually, except when he was angry. Then he was very angry. This is fine. Better to be just what we are. And look at us here. Is Andrea Martin here today? She's usually sitting back there. Andrea's just finished the first book of Katagiri Roshi, the fourth book of Katagiri Roshi's teaching. It's a great book. It's coming out in November now, I think. And, pardon?
That's what we think.
Yeah. Shambhala's done four books on my teacher's, the founder of this Zen Center's teaching. And a lot of people have read them. And where's Ben Conley now? Does anybody know?
He's in New York.
Yeah, he's in New York. He's been traveling around the United States, teaching from his book, his Yogacara book, his second book. My second book is coming out in a few months. Lately, and my first book, Nothing Holy About It, I get emails from people. Actually, they come to Zen Center, and then I may or may not choose to. Kim just says they come to the main office, and then I can respond to them or not. Well, I've been getting one from a guy in Ireland who's been practicing Zen meditation for a long time. And so I started communicating with him. And he's asking me questions about my book. I don't remember, so I have to go find my book. Because I want to be wise, so I should remember what I said, right? And now he says he wants to be a Zen priest. I think, jeez. Well, I've always wanted to go to Ireland. So I'm part Irish, and I've never gone. So conceptual teachings, verbal teachings, scriptures, commentaries, phrases, they help us. They help us, right? Whether we're beginning, whether we're in the middle, or whether we've been practicing for a long time. On the other hand, the complement to that is the natural world. The natural world. And this is what the Taoists emphasize, that we can be with the sky, be with the earth, be with water, and appreciate the mystery as it manifests itself in the natural world. So our first guy in Zen is Bodhidharma. And last time I talked about how Bodhidharma is the father in terms of representing long, hard, disciplined sitting, 9 years until his legs fall off. Well, that's pretty fatherly, isn't it? But in regard to the natural world, versus conceptual teaching, Bodhidharma's the mother. He's the mother. Where does he hang out? In a cave, in nature. He's in nature for his whole career as a teacher. And what does he say about verbal conceptual teachings? He says a special teaching outside the scriptures, no dependence on words and letters, direct pointing to the heart and mind. So he's echoing the early Taoists. He's echoing the early Taoists. And 700 years later, Dogen is echoing him when he says, monkeys cry from the mountaintops, echoing mysteriously in the valley. I listen only to the preaching of this scripture. So now I'm going to spend maybe 5 minutes or a little longer running through some research that's been done on being in nature, the healthful benefits of being in nature. In case you didn't know that there were any healthful benefits, this research has been done in the last 10 years, and I want to thank Ann Balicki for giving me a book that helped me, that put me onto this research. So, four ways being in nature affects our brains and our bodies. Number one, it decreases stress. And I'm going to go through a bunch of research really quickly now. So you can choose to pay attention to it or not, right? In Japan, two groups were assigned to walk either in a forest or an urban center, taking walks of equal length and difficulty, while having their heart rate variability, their heart rate, and their blood pressure measured. Those who walked in forests had significantly lower heart rates and higher heart rate variability, indicating more relaxation and less stress. In Finland, two groups strolled for as little as 20 minutes through an urban park or woodland and reported significantly more stress relief than those who strolled in a city center. Third study. Study of stress with an experimental group and a control group. One group looked at a movie. Another looked out at a window onto a natural scene. The nature group's stress plummeted. The movie group, depending on the movie, stress either stayed the same or increased. So, and we here have our porch facing the lake. And I've been leading retreats here for years. Everybody likes to hang out on the porch. Everybody faces the lake. During breaks, few people go lie down, but most people just seem to hang out just facing the lake, or in the nice weather, going out to the lake. Wonderful, isn't it, that we're able to do that here in the middle of a city? Pretty wonderful. Flower arrangements. I got a new flower arrangement this morning. I went in my office, and the moment I opened the door, I saw the new flower arrangement on my altar. I felt something. I felt it's just a stillness, a joy that nature is showing us. M- my altars, I have Buddhas, but I have rocks. I have more rocks than Buddhas. Different rocks. My altar at home, my altar here. Number two, being in nature makes you happier and less brooding. Gregory Bratman of Stanford University randomly assigned 60 participants to a 50-minute walk in either oak woodlands or an urban setting. Those who walked in nature experienced less anxiety and negative affect, as well as more positive emotions. Study number two. This is the finding number two of this experiment. They reported decreased rumination after the walk and showed increased activity in the subgenual prefrontal cortex, an area of the brain whose deactivation is affiliated with depression and anxiety. So I had to Google this. I'm supposed to know about this because I used to be a psychologist, but I don't really, so I can Google stuff. Sound like I know it, right? This is pretty cool, isn't it? So here, again, we're pretty lucky. We started doing our walking meditation in the backyard about 10 years ago. I said, let's just start doing our walking meditation in the backyard. Why do we have to hang out here? So we do all our walking meditation in the backyard. I hope they do it in the evening. I don't know. But I'm here in the morning. We do it every morning. And then about 8 years ago, we started in our retreats having a mindfulness walk, a long mindfulness walk along the lake and back up through the trail. Well, I think we'll probably need to gravitate to more and more of those and less painful sitting. Why not? Why not? If we're going to support the mama, Taoism, of course, there's the dad who's saying, you know, gotta sit. So we're both. Number three, being in nature relieves attention fatigue and increases creativity. Dr. Strayer, two experiments by Dr. Strayer. In a 2012 study, hikers on a four-day backpacking trip could solve significantly more puzzles requiring creativity when compared to a control group of people waiting to take the same hike. In fact, 40% more. Dr. Strayer says, when you use your cell phones to talk, text, shoot photos, or whatever else you can do with your cell phone, you're tapping the prefrontal cortex and causing reductions in cognitive resources. Makes sense, doesn't it? Second experiment. Monitoring people's EEG readings while they walked in an arboretum, either while talking on their cell phones or not. Participants with cell phones had EEG readings consistent with attention overload. Consistent with attention overload. All the people walking around the lake yesterday, I walked around. How many of them were really enjoying it, and how many were doing attention overload? My goodness. And these people could recall only half as many details of the arboretum they just passed through. Strayer says, if you've been using your brain to multitask, as most of us do most of the day, and then you set that aside and go on a walk without all of the gadgets, you've let the prefrontal cortex recover. And that's when we see these bursts in creativity, problem solving, and feelings of well-being. Dogen, as I listened, I became the sound of the rain on the eve. As I listened, I became the sound of the rain on the eve. Can't do that with a cell phone. Can't do that with a cell phone. Fourth, kindness and generosity. Kindness and generosity. Paul Pitt at UC Berkeley worked with a group of participants. Some participants gazed up at a grove of towering eucalyptus trees for 1 minute, while others standing in the same spot just stared at the side of a large building, like we do in Zazen. Then a researcher accidentally dropped a box of pens. The study participants who had been looking up at the awe-inspiring trees picked up more pens to help out. Uh. So immersion in nature. Immersion in nature. The Taoists were the first holy fools. The holy fools we find in different corners of different spiritual traditions. But they always immerse themselves in nature. They may be unconventional in their attitude. They may be kind of silly and iconoclastic. But they've tapped into something that gives them a great joy. That's not a thing. That's not a thing. So the Taoists is the first holy fools, but we also have holy fools in Christianity. San Simeon in the Eastern Orthodox Church. St. Francis. What did Frank Francis do? He hung out in nature. He talked to the birds. He listened to the birds. He talked to the animals. He listened to the animals. You can say he was just in his head. No, he wasn't just in his head. If you read him, you realize that he had sunk into this great mystery and was appreciating it. And the natural world around him, the natural world was helping him appreciate it. He called himself and his disciples the Lord's jesters. And a couple of times he appeared stark naked in church. He shook everyone up. Everyone was shaken up. He wasn't consistent. He didn't follow the right form. But we know about his life. You've read about his life. He was wonderful. He was sweet. He knew about this stillness that's always here. And in so this Taoist type influence, of course, St. Francis didn't read the Taoists. He just tapped into the same thing, right? And we have the Japanese Zen teachers, Ryokan, the holy fool, and Ikkyu, wild and joyful sexuality, wild and joyful. Everybody at the time was aghast. But now, for the last 250 years, he's been a great hero. Just like people were aghast with St. Francis's behavior at first. So now I want to read some Taoist poems. One of the early Taoist poets, Hanshan, also known as Cold Mountain, and his poems were written on mountains, trees, rocks, and walls. So I'm going to read three of them, I think. Yeah, three, and talk to you a little bit about them. Or not all of them. First, climbing up the cold mountain path. The cold mountain trail goes on and on. Long gorge, choked with scree and boulders, wide creek, mist-blurred grass. Moss is slippery, though there's been no rain. The pine sings, but there's no wind. Who can leap the world's ties and sit with me among the white clouds? Who can leap the world's ties and sit with me among the white clouds? The next one. Someone lives in a mountain gorge, cloud robe and sunset tassels, holding sweet plants he wants to share. The path up is long and hard, the climber burdened by regrets and doubts. Finally, he meets an old man, called by others out of it, yet joyfully serene in his stupidity. Someone lives in a mountain gorge. Not the top of the mountain. Both Suzuki and Katagiri, when they were looking to establish monasteries in the country, said, not the top of the mountain. We should go to the base of the mountain. Of course, Minnesota has hardly any mountains. So it was kind of limited in Minnesota, but we did find a beautiful location. They said, not at the top of a mountain, but if possible, by water. So Tassajara in California, first Zen monastery in the United States, deep in the Big Sur Mountains, deep in the Carmel Valley Mountains, by water. Hokyoji, and there's some beautiful hills. Those are mountains by Minnesota standards, and a creek flowing through. The first time we went there, we had to cross the creek to get in. So that's interesting. That's interesting. Taoism and Feng Shui come from the same source. How many of you know about Feng Shui? Raise your hand. Most of you know about Feng Shui, so I'm not going to talk about it. You can ask others about it. But Feng Shui is about the ideal environment for us to be in. And the most nurturing spaces for humans to find our still center, according to Feng Shui, is below a mountain or by water or both. So here we're lucky. We're by water and we're below this little mountain here on the backyard, right? Someone lives in a mountain gorge, cloud robes, and sunset tassels. So clothed by nature, rather than robes that need to be worn in a particular, specific, so-called Buddhist way. Holding sweet plants, he wants to share. The sweet plants of that help us imbibe the great mystery. All we have to do is taste the plant. We imbibe it. It doesn't even have to be psychedelic. It's just because it is, it's psychedelic. Its psychedelic feature is its life. Someone lives in a mountain gorge, cloud robe and sunset tassels, holding sweet plants he wants to share. The path up is long and hard, the climber burdened by regrets and doubts. Finally, he meets an old man, called by others out of it, yet joyfully serene in his stupidity. Third one by Hanshan. Instead of seeking to find the Tao, notice that your nature is naturally so. What heaven bestows is perfect. Looking for something else leads you astray. Leaving the trunk to search among the twigs, all you get is confusion. So our nature is naturally so. No need to impose spiritual concepts on our nature. It's naturally so. Rules for behavior, rituals which are the one true way, we don't need to impose those. We can bask in the stillness that's right here. What heaven bestows is perfect. Leaving the trunk to search among the twigs, all you get is confusion. So the trunk, right here, the trunk, rather than getting caught by the twigs. The twigs are attractive. The leaves are attractive. They're wonderful. We should enjoy them. But just come back to the trunk. Trunk supports us. Sometimes Hanshan could stroll for hours in the corridors of the monastery below Cold Mountain, where he lived, occasionally letting out a cheerful cry, or laughing, or talking to himself. Talking to himself? That's prohibited in Zen, isn't it? Isn't that prohibited?
I do it.
He's advanced. When taken to task or driven away by the monks, he would stand still afterwards, laugh, clap his hands, and disappear. And his best buddy, for those of you who don't know, was a guy named Shite. And here I'm passing out pictures of Hanshan and Shite hanging out together. I'll pass them around. Hanshan and Shite hanging out together. Shite was an orphan. That's what Shite means. It means orphan. He was found as a child by Feng Kan, the monk Feng Kan, who brought him up in the monastery below Cold Mountain. He worked in the dining hall in the kitchen, and he supplied Hanshan with leftovers. There wasn't too much food up in Cold Mountain. So Hanshan descended to the monastery, befriended Shite, and Shite snuck him food. You guys can keep passing that around so that it goes into the other hall. Shite. A couple poems by Shite. Of course, Hanshan is Hanshan and Shite is Shite. How can common fools recognize us? Though Fencon, he knows us. When worldlings wish to see us, they can't. When looking for us, where would they search? Another poem by Shite. Behold the glow of the moon, illuminating the world's four quarters. Perfect light in perfect space, a radiance that purifies. People say it waxes and wanes. I don't see it fade. Like a magic pearl, it shines both night and day. Like a magic pearl, it shines both night and day. Here's Dogen 400 years later. All the world in the 10 directions are one bright pearl. Don't say two pearls or three pearls. The whole body is this one single true eye of Dharma. This whole body is one bright pearl. A great mystery manifesting itself right within our monkey minds. We don't have to get rid of our monkey minds. They're the manifestation of the great mystery. Just as they are. Just as they are. So, another Taoist poem, poet Yung Kanzi. Clear waters drift through the immensity of a tall forest. In front of me, a huge river mouth receives the long wind. Deep ripples hold white sand and white fish swimming as in a void. I sprawl on a big rock, billows nourishing my humble body. I gargle with water and wash my feet. A fisherman pauses out on the surf. So many fish long for bait. I look only to the east with its lotus flowers, with its lotus leaves and flowers. So many fish long for bait. We long for some spiritual sustenance. We long, we do as human beings. But he looks only to the east, with its lotus leaves growing out of the mud and the beautiful flowers that grow out of those. One more poem, and then I think I'm done, and we'll see if there's any discussion, okay? Oh, no, I've got a couple more things to say. I better get back on script, don't you think? I got to be a good Buddhist. Enough of this Taoist spontaneity. Back on script. The script says there's another poem in here by Yun Kanza. By willow's shade, back up against shadows of the pine, all karma stops. Monkey mind is skewered, corralled by the bright moon. Monkey mind is skewered, corralled by the bright moon. Breeze pure, alone I speak of endless life. Alone I speak of endless life. So these are all Chinese nature poems, deeply influenced by Taoism. And when I was a young man, and as I am now an old man, and practicing Zen, I like to read Chinese nature poems very much, very much. And when I was living in San Francisco as a young man, one Chinese nature poem that I was fond of helped me when I was having a hard time. I was having a hard time in the winter in San Francisco. Now, you may think winter in San Francisco, but winter in San Francisco is worse than winter here. There's no sun, and it's wet. There's no sun, and it's wet. So I made a pledge. I dropped out of college. I made a pledge to go to Zazen every morning in San Francisco. But I didn't want to go after a while. I just wanted to stay in my snuggly bed. Especially I'd peek out and it would just be mist and fog and so on. I was kind of went into a depressive funk, but I kept my Chinese poetry there with me. And one poem I taped on my alarm clock. And this is the poem I taped on my alarm clock. Lumberjacks swarm the mountainside, axing everything in sight. Yet crimson flowers burn along the stream. You understand the metaphor without my explaining it, I think. One more time. Lumberjacks inside here swarm the mountainside, axing everything in sight. Yet crimson flowers always growing along the stream, always growing along the stream. So I taped that to my alarm clock, and then in the dark, I reached for the off button on my alarm clock, but I couldn't get beyond the paper because I had it scotch taped right on top. So when I saw the paper, then I got up. Usually. Or a lot of the time. Or some of the time. Some of the time is pretty good. From a mama's point of view, Taoist mama's point of view, one time is good enough. Or from the Buddhist teacher's point of view, every time. Every time. Just get up. Just get up. Right? So, I use that as a help. You guys use your own things as helps, right? You use your own ways in bringing nature into your life as a help. Whether it's a little flower arrangement, some rocks on your bureau, or whatever you do. Use it. And then that same winter, when I was having such a hard time, during our retreats, we'd have breaks and we'd go out on the street. We were allowed to go out in the street during our breaks. And there was no nature on the street in that part of San Francisco. No nature. I don't even remember any trees, just cars rushing by. But anyway, we'd go outside. And then one day, I went outside during a retreat, during a break, and I was kind of in a grumpy mood, but I looked down on the sidewalk, and there was a clover bursting through the sidewalk with its leaves and a little flower bursting through the sidewalk. And it helped me. I just felt calm. I felt still. I felt joyful as I looked at it. So those little weeds in the sidewalk became my own crimson flowers. Sustained me during that winter. So now a final Taoist poem. Look at the birds. Even flying is born out of nothing. The first sky is inside you, open at either end of day. The work of wings is always freedom, fastening one heart to every falling thing. Look at the birds. Even flying is born out of nothing. The great mystery of nothing manifests itself as everything, as everything. Flaws or no flaws. Ecstasy or depression. It's the energy of life coursing through us, as us. Like birds, we can let go of the comforting certainty of the earth and meet the space of the open sky and enjoy its wonderful currents. We can all do that. Nature shows us how to do that. Zazen shows us how to do that. The first sky is inside you, open at either end of the day. At either end of the day. These traditionally are the sacred times, dawn and dusk. Sunrise and sunset, but you have to tune into it. You have to look out the window. You have to be with the sunset. You have to go to the lake. Go to Minnehaha Creek. They're not that far off. Just be with them. If you spend 3 minutes at the beginning or the end of the day just imbibing nature, you'll get a sense of what I'm talking about when I say this great mystery supports us always. You get that sense. You don't need to do any zazen. Just 3 minutes I meant this up for today. Because I'm feeling like a mama today rather than a papa. 3 minutes in the morning and the evening. Don't do anything. Just, and if there's, you can't see the sunset, that's okay. You can see the clouds. If it's only raining, hear the rain on the eaves. Let it enter you. Let it permeate you, penetrate you. You'll discover this stillness that's always here. You will. Look at the birds. Even flying is born out of nothing. The first sky is inside you, open at either end of day. So the outer sky helps us get in touch with the inner sky, doesn't it? If we appreciate the outer sky and it feels peaceful, that means inside there's a little bit of sky. We wouldn't appreciate that outer sky if it weren't for the inner sky. The first sky is inside you, open at either end of day. The work of wings is always freedom. So it's some work. It's some work for us, especially in the city, especially with busy lives, to spend time close to nature, to do our zazen regularly. It's some work. And sometimes it feels like the wings don't work. We're still on the ground. We're flapping, flapping, flapping. But the work of wings is always freedom. Meaning that if we develop the muscle, we develop the openness, we begin to settle into stillness, we don't know we're settling into it. And after a while, we rise a little bit above all the stuff that we're caught by. We glide through our lives rather than, I don't know, rather than grovel all the time, worry all the time, be upset all the time. The first sky is inside you, open at either end of day. Then our head doesn't weigh us down anymore. It doesn't weigh us down. The work of wings is always freedom, fastening your heart to every falling thing. So sooner or later, this practice lifts you. It lifts you. And you're lighter in your head. You're just lighter. And then you can open your heart so much more easily to other beings who are falling, other beings who are caught. You just naturally do it. Naturally, you do it. You don't have to try to be a bodhisattva. You just are, because your heart is open. Your heart is open. So I think that's what I want to say for today. And I'll be glad to entertain just about anything. You could even take off your clothes, I guess, since it's Dallas talk. Yeah.
I just want to reflect on sort of the meaning that I got from some of this, in that it seems like I can appreciate a both and, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the mother and all that.
Yeah.
But what I've noticed in my life is I try to, if one is too much, I want to force the other one.
That's too much father.
That's too much
about it.
Yes. And what I'm getting from this is the stillness allows me to know when it's natural to flow from it.
As much as possible. Yes, yes. It takes some faith because for so much of our practice, we don't know that stillness. But as soon as you tap into it, you begin to develop a confidence. A confidence that's not this sort of confidence that's just intellectual where you've got things figured out. You don't need to have things figured out because life figures it out. Life and death are always figuring everything out. So, yes, thank you. But when you say, not enough, not doing it right, that's father. And some father is fine, but we've got to... This is Zen, so let's not just mash the mama. Other people. Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes we can be a little bit contradictory, like we'll be outside and think how wonderful it is to be outside with nature until that first mosquito bites.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good. That's a good point. Yes. Well, Paul and I can speak to that. Paul Courtney and I have spent time in nature when it hasn't been very friendly. What?
I said,
Yeah. That's right. So let's not romanticize nature. Nature doesn't care about us. If it's going to storm, it's going to storm. If the bugs are going to come out, they're going to come out. But if we can just be with that, it's wonderful. That's wonderful. It doesn't mean we don't go into our tents when the mosquitoes are eating us up. But with the life force of that mosquito, wow, the Tao coursing through the mosquito. Pretty cool. Pretty cool. What a life it has. Sucking blood and getting all filled up and then dying. And then, wow. Pretty cool. Pretty cool. Yeah.
So, a couple weeks ago during a Bhushas retreat, during work practice, we got the storm windows down and then we opened the windows up. And I don't know, I feel like that was almost like a turning point for me during the retreat, getting those windows open and hearing, feeling the breeze, hearing the birds, seeing the grass.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Could you hear him? Oh, that could hurt you. Okay. Yeah, wonderful. We never know. We never know. But if we can just let go of our preconceptions, we'll have these experiences, these spontaneous experiences, all of a sudden feeling connected. But if we get too interested in having that kind of experience, we don't have it. Because we're interested in it rather than just opening up to the mystery of things that are as they are right here, to life as it is right here. Carrie.
It makes me think of watching children, or when I was a child, that even though I grew up in the inner city of St. Paul, I found my way to trees. My favorite playing spots was under a pine tree in my front yard. I lived right on the river bluff.
Yeah.
I'd cross the street to go to the boulevard and climb trees there. And
yeah.
Now I watch other little children remember my kids when they were young and how they're drawn you know, to that. Even if you live in the city, they want to play in the dirt, they want to be in sand.
That's right. That's right. They instinctually feel the nurturing vibes and the sense of connectedness. One of my earliest memories, I grew up in a town where there were not too many trees. Now there are lots of trees there, and there was one tree that I would, you know, when I'm a really old guy. I'm almost 74. So when I went to school, kids walked to school by themselves. So I walked to school by myself to kindergarten, and there was one tree on my way to and from kindergarten that I liked to climb. And once I climbed the top of that tree on my way home from kindergarten, and I fell out of the tree into the dry stream bed below, and I fell right on my hara, right on my tummy, and I thought I was going to die because I couldn't breathe. And I told the kid next to me, who was up on the bank, I said, run home and tell my mom I'm dying. So he ran home to tell my mom I was dying. But by the time my mom got there, I discovered I could breathe and I was back up on the tree again. So thank you, Carrie. Thank you. What else? Benton.
Have an expression called forest bathing.
Forest baby?
Bathing.
Oh, forest bathing, yeah. Yeah, do you want to say something about that?
That's all I needed to say. It's pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah.
Going out into the nature, in forest, just to absorb.
And one of these pieces of research I read about, they talked about forest bathing.
Was it Mark Twain who said the coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco?
He did say that. Yeah. Okay, well, anything more?
Yeah,
Well, thank you. And enjoy the outside today. Or if you can't be outside, just look out the window. And if you can't look out the window, just look at a weed that's coming in from the crevice of your house.